Welcome to today's podcast. I am delighted to be joined here at the UCD Geary Institute of Public Policy with none other than Associate Professor Isil Tonahan from the Department of Politics here at UCD. So thank you very much for taking part today.
Delighted to be here.
So if it's okay, Isil, I'm just going to give a little bit of background about your work and what you're interested in, if that's okay. So you, as I said, have been here at the Department of Politics for many years in Spire, working as an Associate Professor. You're also a member of the Royal Irish Academy, as well as a recipient of the UCD President's Research Award. And your specific area of interest, I suppose, is political theory, particularly civic republicanism and political thought. And I must say that I am so glad that I met you, and I met you when I was doing my master's here at UCD, and I wandered into your office, and you very kindly have taken me under your wing since then when you were involved in work on the task force on active citizenship, and you were very, very helpful with me and the work that I was doing at the time. So very, very grateful for your help and your generosity and your experience. And once again, here I am asking you for help, so thank you very much. I'm absolutely delighted to have you on board. So today we're going to be discussing John Locke, who is one of the 16 key thinkers on the new Politics and Society course for Leaving Cert. So just, I suppose, to give a little bit of background, I guess, about John Locke, because, I mean, really, he was born in 1632. He passed away in 1704. He was an English philosopher and physician. How is somebody who has been so long gone still so relevant today?
Well, that's a really good question. You know, why do we study all these dead white men? And the fact is that in the case of Locke and some others, but Locke is a really good example. They lived at in really turbulent times, at times when things were changing. And they were in the thick of the action. Think about the 17th century in England. It was a time when they executed the king, for you royal watchers, they executed the king, and they had a republic for over 10 years in England.
So there was no monarchy at all in England?
There was no monarchy. This was the time it was called the Protectorate, and Oliver Cromwell was the leader of government and fairly powerful, but it wasn't a monarchy. And then as that didn't work out so well after he died, the decision was to bring back the monarchy and set it up again, and we all know that that's gone on ever since. But it was a real time of ferment in England, and people were arguing about what kind of government there should be, how much power governments should have, how much power individuals should have, how much freedom people could have. Everything was up for grabs in a way maybe that it hadn't been before, and Locke was in the middle of this. Yes, he was from a fairly ordinary family. He went to university to study classics, as he did at the time, but he stayed on in university to study medicine. And he got to know a noble called the Earl of Shaftesbury, who he tutored his children. And he impressed the Earl of Shaftesbury, particularly when the Earl of Shaftesbury had a liver ailment, and Locke designed a treatment to improve it. But the Earl of Shaftesbury also influenced Locke, because he had been mixed up, because it was the nobles who used to be most resistant to the king. He'd been mixed up with certain kind of political movements, and he brought Locke into that. And Locke had started off as a conservative.
The Whigs.
He was one of the Whigs who were resisting the power of the king.
So they wanted monarchy, but they wanted constitutional monarchy as opposed to absolute monarchy. Is that
correct? Yes, they wanted to limit the powers of the king. They probably didn't have the word constitutional monarchy even in their mind, but they knew they didn't want the king to be too powerful.
But they did want a king at the same time.
But they did want a king. This was after the Republic, and they thought that was too chaotic and much of a free-for-all. They wanted the power of the aristocracy to be established. They wanted, you know, a settled...
Was that because that was in their own interest as noble people?
Yes,
they kind of still wanted
that.
Own
interest. Yes. Yeah. So it was the question of, you know, a balance between the king's power and the power of the nobility, because it was the lords versus the king, and of course there were the commons as well, but the commons didn't have very much power.
And the reason that there was a particular worry about Catholics taking over...
Yes. Well, partly it was that... It was, Catholicism was seen as an authoritarian doctrine which would justify greater power for the king than the Protestantism that had come in since Henry VIII and become the established religion in Britain. So one thing that the nobility feared most, and people of political persuasion, was the restoration of a Catholic king. And at that time, the royal family were a bit uncertain about whether they really wanted to be Protestants or Catholics. And the king at the time of Locke, Charles II wasn't really very interested in religion, but when he died, the chances were that he would be succeeded by his brother James, who
because
was
he didn't
Catholic.
Have any children himself.
Well, he had children, but they were illegitimate mostly.
Ah, right.
When he was succeeded by his brother, because he had no legitimate heirs, and his brother was a Catholic, and he also was a person of very authoritarian views. And the kind of idea that God gives power, that the power of the king is God-given, was something that had been building up in the 16th century. The earlier king, James I, had written a book on the divine right of kings. So the kings were trying to build up the justification for their absolute power, and the nobles and others were trying to resist that absolute power without kind of getting rid of the monarchy completely. So long before Charles died, there was a lot of movement going on in politics to try and limit the power of government or make sure a Catholic didn't get into power. And none of that succeeded. And Locke was mixed up with groups of people who were involved in this resistance, some of whom were actually try to assassinate the king and his brother on their way home from the Newmarket races at one point, and got arrested and executed. So Locke wasn't an armchair philosopher by any manner of means.
Yes, he was very
active.
He was
in the thick of this political movement. And it's interesting to note that they were executed as much for what they wrote as what they did, because kings knew that political ideas were very powerful, and seditious ideas being published about public or the limit of the government.
I guess when people who have experienced power and privilege for a very, very long period of time, and that is threatened, you know, I guess things can become very, very turbulent, and the people that they're going to hit out most are the people who are speaking up and out against that.
Yes.
But to put it into context of that kind of time, it would be the same thing as if now we decided there was never going to be any president, we're going to take Michael D. Higgins off the stand, we're going to take away our entire government, and then the people had to start having this conversation about how we were now going to organise ourselves, and decisions would need to be made very, very quickly, and I guess everyone's jostling for power, you know.
Yes.
Do we want...
And of course it's not a complete vacuum, it's not the people making a decision. There are those who are in positions of power, like there was in the time. It was the leaders in the army or the leaders in the parliament already, who they were the people who were making decisions and wanted to make sure that things didn't get completely out of hand and stop change at a certain point and so forth. Mm. So, but anyway, under Charles II, Locke and his friends were very worried about what would happen in the future and worried about the king accumulating powers on his successor being even worse. But when Locke's friends were jailed and some of them executed, he went into exile out of England because he was so much afraid of what might happen to himself. And his patron, the Earl of Shaftesbury, he was in prison a lot of the time as well. So there was real clampdown on political opinions at the time.
And so just to summarise again, Locke didn't start off his life as a politician by any means. He was a physician, he was a doctor, he went to Oxford and trained specifically in the matters of the liver, and then he became friends with Shaftesbury through education, he was looking after his sons, and then all of a sudden things changed politically with the country, and he found himself drawn in there as much by his own thoughts that he was just putting out there, but driven by this sense of what is right and what is wrong, this ethical and moral need to contribute to that.
Now, Locke was really important for other aspects of philosophy as well. He wrote a really important book before he got into politics, really, about how we understand things and the nature of human knowledge and stuff, which is really important in another branch of philosophy. It doesn't concern us today. But as you say, he got sucked into politics because of the urgency of the times.
I think maybe that's how a lot of people kind of become involved in politics. Sometimes we look at people who are kind of in power and in government and we think, God, I don't have the connections to be there, or I don't have the knowledge to be there. But a lot of people actually get involved in politics because they feel so passionate about a specific thing, or they feel that they have to. They actually now have to. Things have come to a point where they have to stand up and kind of stand up for what they believe is right. And that's a perfectly legitimate reason to get involved in politics. In fact, it's probably one of the best reasons to get involved in politics. He was obviously the reason why he's so important, and it was one of the 16 key thinkers on this course, is because he's one of the most influential people in terms of political theory. He's considered the father of liberalism.
Yes. Now, he didn't think of himself as a liberal, and liberalism means lots of different things to different people.
Yes, but we might talk about that a little bit in a while.
Okay. But if it's about freedom, which it often is. I think that's a good kind of core concept, although people take it differently. That liberals think it's important for individuals to be free in a certain way. And Locke believed that individuals were born with certain natural rights to life, liberty and property, as he said.
And actually, that exact phrase, life, liberty and the pursuit of happiness, was they trace that back to Locke, which is a part of the American Declaration of Independence.
Exactly.
Life, liberty, so, and you said life, liberty.
Life, liberty and property was property. What he said, okay. Yes. But he has been enormously influential in that respect. But he thought that individuals had natural rights that weren't dependent on what they were given by the government, and that they couldn't give up those natural rights. Now, Hobbes thought people had natural rights, but he said you have to choose between rights and security and peace. And if you want to live a peaceful life, you've got to prepare to give up all your rights to government. Locke said, yes, we need government because you can't rely on people always doing the right thing. So we need somebody to keep the peace and so forth and to resolve conflicts. But there are certain rights that individuals cannot give up. They're what he called inalienable rights that you can't give up, the rights of life, liberty and property. Now, that doesn't mean you can't be taxed on your property and so on, but you have to be represented at least in how that taxation is applied. So that's the one way in which Locke is really important and the way in which he's a forerunner of liberalism, because we all now believe in individual rights, and we think there are certain limits to what anybody can do to an individual, especially what government can do to an individual. That's one way in which Locke was very influential. But the main goal of his book, The Two Treatises on Government,
That's was, 1670 he wrote that, roughly, was it?
He was writing it in that time, but it wasn't published until much later because it was really seen as a very dangerous book to be writing. The key point of the book is that nobody has natural authority from God to rule over anybody else. Governments don't have natural authority. That they depend for their authority on the consent of the people. And as a result, and this is the most important part for him, when governments take over power that they shouldn't have or extend their power beyond its limits, the people have a right to resist them and to rise up in rebellion against them.
Not just a right sometimes, but sometimes an obligation.
Even a duty, yes. And this means that for Locke, there are limits to government, that the powers of government must be limited. So the government depends on the consent of the people and the power of the government must be limited. It can never override those natural rights of the individual to life and to liberty. He says, because he says, you have to think as if all government is based on the consent of the governed, in some sort of sense. Now, it doesn't mean that you can ever say, well, when did I ever consent to be governed? Because you won't easily find when you did. And it doesn't mean that governments can't act unless people consent to them. But it means that if governments act in ways that people could never consent to, then the people have a right to resist them and to rise up in rebellion and replace them with another government.
So he's constantly, like, kind of his underlying question constantly that he's trying to figure out within his work is what does it take to make a legitimate government? What is legitimate in terms of how we're governed and how people are entitled to that power?
Yes, and he does this by tracking right back, if you like, and going back down to the bottom to find, well, where might government come from? He says, well, government must come from some kind of agreement of people to surrender some of their rights in order to get security. Not all their rights, but some of their rights in order to get more security. What's really interesting about Locke and makes him different from some modern liberals is that he thinks that it's really important that individuals be free. But free doesn't mean a free for all. He thinks that individuals are free to act themselves within the certain moral law. And he thinks that people can, through their reason, work out what is right and wrong, what is the moral law, and that they're obliged to obey that. So for he would say freedom is not the same as license. License means you can do whatever you like, but your freedom only extends to not being subject to the will of another person.
So it's that whole free from or free to kind of argument. And he felt that people should be free from being,
being directed by somebody else's will.
Yes,
but not free from law. So he said law actually is a way of making you free. And he says we wouldn't say that hedges and ditches on the side of the road, or we might say motorway barriers, stop you being free from driving wherever you want, because they actually protect you from falling down into the ditch. You should think of the laws in the same sort of way. They guide us in the way that's best for us, rather than being a limit on our freedom. So he thinks that you're only free as far as you can be free without harming yourself or other people, because he thinks all of this for Locke is actually directed by God, and that the moral law, although we can discern it from our own secular reason, our own personal reason, he thinks it is God-given, and our lives are given to us by God. So he is relying on religious ideas there.
That's something that kind of, like, in reading various bits and in terms of my research putting together this podcast, you know, like this, he's constantly kind of going back and referring to God in his work. Is it possible to get a lot from working from Locke's work and Locke's theories, even if you're an atheist and you don't believe in God? Is it is it possible to apply his theory in a non-religious?
There are different views on this, but I think I think it's important to think that there are different views. And some people say that really our idea of individual rights and today human rights today needs more foundation than we have for it at the moment. Locke's foundation for it was, well, God created us equal and free and so forth, so that's why we have individual rights. Nowadays, many people don't believe in God, they're atheists or whatever, but they still believe in human rights. But what's their foundation for the freedom and equality of human beings? So some people think there's a missing foundation there. Others would say, no, we can use our human reason now to construct the reasons why people should be free and equal. But it's not the obvious answer to your question is not an obvious one. It's actually, maybe some people say, it's something we still need to work on, because as we know, in many parts of the world, even the idea of human rights is an equal human rights and free natural freedom is not accepted by all governments or by everyone throughout the world. Mm-hmm. In some religious perspectives, not all humans are equal. In some religious perspective, freedom is not necessarily valued, particularly. So if you want to think of, you know, natural human rights as being universally applicable, well, perhaps we still need to develop better arguments for that. And there are people trying to do that.
Yes. He was very legal in terms of a lot of his stuff. In fact, it seems a lot of his work was kind of mapping blueprints of what he felt like, you know, like, it wasn't just one grand theory. He actually went down to the nitty-gritty of what he felt the rules of this theory and how it should play out should be. For example, when he talks about justifying resistance and disobedience against an unjust power, you know, he says that people have the right to revolt and a just war. So he said that, you know, there could be wars in order to gain peace, that people could even go that far. But there are rules, according to Locke, rules of this revolution. And one very interesting one, the first rule, when you think about how, you know, he opposed monarchy and absolute monarchy, but the first rule of his rules of revolution was that the king is sacred. The king cannot be harmed. Mm. Which goes back to his religious theoretical beliefs, I guess. And it's just an interesting kind of crossover of his understanding of power and the order of how society should work and that religious thing. And then how he still has that ultimate respect for
that's
a king,
right.
really.
Yeah, well, there's interesting things. I remember one thing that's important to remember is he came back to England on the same ship as Mary of William and Mary, who were to be the king and queen of England from then on. And he had a job under that monarchy. So he wasn't opposed to monarchy as such.
Yes.
He was opposed to the sort of absolute monarchy that existed before. He also wasn't opposed to government. He believed government was necessary. So he wasn't an anarchist of the kind who believes that human beings could live together in peace without government. He thinks that in principle they might be able to, but in practice they usually aren't, and therefore we need government.
So he wasn't like a total opposite of Hobbes then in that regard. He had a lot in common with Hobbes in one sense, but he had this also, he wanted monarchy, but he wanted this supporting legal system, a government that made it all legitimate.
That's right. And the thing is, it's funny, sometimes you say that you start off with a viewpoint that is moderate and then somebody else develops an extreme viewpoint. But in the case of Hobbes and Locke, Hobbes is first. He's the man with the extreme point. He says you either choose between freedom, so you either choose freedom or you choose security. If you want a monarch, it's got to be absolute. It's really extreme. It's wholly consistent. Whereas Locke is more moderate, middle of the road sort of guy who sees a bit of this and the point of this and point of the other side as well. So that he's much more ready to accommodate to sort of each side of the question. So he sees the value of monarchy, but also the value of the limits to monarchy. But one thing about the sorts of arguments that you talked about, that he brings out very specific argument, often he's trying to answer people who are going to disagree with him. Now, some things about this book, it's important to know that this book was regarded as so revolutionary because it was written at the time when all this turmoil was going on, though it wasn't published till later. It was seen as a seditious book. He didn't dare put his name to it. It was published anonymously.
Wow, and he fled to the Netherlands then after
well,
that.
He had been, yeah, he was away. He was away for a good deal at that time, but when he was writing it, yes, at the time of the changes. So that's the first thing. The second thing is to note that he's trying to respond to the people who will criticise him. It's a very political book in the sense
and
that
just for our listeners, that's a really important part of when you're writing a good essay or you're writing a good paper or whatever you're doing. You've got to remember that there are going to be critics of whatever your idea is. And if you can manage to think about all the angles that people are going to come at you and tackle your work and kind of criticise you, pop them in as well. Kind of, you know, like, look for other people's arguments against your work. It's the best kind of form of defence, really. Sorry to interrupt you there.
No, that's fine. No, that's a really good point. But he's anxious to knock down the arguments of his critics before they get a chance to make them. But he's also trying to win over some people. So some people feel that he's moderated his argument in ways in order to win over people who might be in the middle that he could win. So he's really anxious for to say, I'm not giving a recipe for anarchy or for everyday revolution. Because people say, if you say that people have a right to resist government, surely there's going to be complete chaos. People are going to refuse to obey the laws here, there and everywhere. And he says, no, that's not the case. First of all, it's not individuals who have the right. No individual has the right to say, I'm against the government and I think it's oppressing me. It's only when the whole people get together and rise up against it. And he says, secondly, people are actually quite reasonable. They live with things that are really difficult. And it's only after they've had years of being oppressed and dominated by the king that they will start to be inclined to rise up and so on. This is trying to calm down the people who will feel that he's preaching anarchy, for example. So a lot of his specific points are to deal with particular kinds of criticisms that he might meet from other people.
Yes. And I think Locke then is a very, very interesting character to have on a Leaving Cert course and to be exposing young people to his theories and his work, specifically because I think the institutions that are secondary schools here in Ireland, like I'm a secondary school teacher myself, and you know, we're coming to a stage in Irish politics where we're trying to include young people and young people's voice more. But of course, schools are not democratically run. It's not a case that one person has one vote and it really can't work, I suppose, in that sense, on a large scale, certainly in one flip of a switch. We couldn't just decide tomorrow, okay, that's it, from now on, all schools are going to be democratic and we're going to just give everybody a free. It would be chaos to do that. But I think you could apply Locke's theory to make schools more democratic, because at the moment it's kind of run almost like an absolute monarchy. You know, you have this ultimate power that's at the top, and the people, the majority of the school, really have no say. But what Locke is proposing is that there should be this absolute power, there should not be absolute power, there should be power, like as in terms of a monarchy or some kind of ruling party, but there should also be this kind of means for people to engage in dissent and you know, to be able to have a basis of rights and to have those protected, but also to be able to engage in.
Yes.
What do you think?
I don't really think that Locke is a democrat. I mean, some of his friends were democrats, but at least the theory that comes across in the treatises on government is not an argument for democracy. It's an argument for limited government. But he's very, and he is in favour of majority rule. But he says, you know, a government can't tax you unless you've agreed. Well, actually, by that I mean that if your representative has agreed, or the majority of the representatives have agreed. Mm-hmm. So he doesn't seem to be in favour. He doesn't think that people without material property really probably should be participating in politics and that. So he's much more important as an antecedent of liberal ideas, that is, about the freedom of the individual, than he is as an antecedent of any democratic ideas. And I think that's important. And I'd just like to say a little bit about the nature of his liberal influences. I think he has been an influence on liberals of all kinds of different kinds. On the one hand, we've talked a bit about the importance of individual rights and how important that is to us now, and how he articulated this idea of individual... He wasn't the first person, but he made it very, very clear very early on. On the other hand, when he says everybody is a property in their own person, and he says at one point that the whole point of government is the protection of property. Now, sometimes he means by that what we call the integrity of the person. That is sort of so important to people now, that other people can't interfere with you and make you do things that are contrary to your will. But on the other hand, he seems often to mean the importance of physical property, that is land and property of that kind. And there's a strand of thought following on from Locke which has led to what we call now neoliberalism, if you like, about the freedom of property and the importance of economic freedom and the freedom of companies and so forth to be able to operate with limited government control, which is quite a different strand of liberalism that also owes its origins to Locke. So there's lots of different things you can find in Locke. There's a really interesting documentary called The Corporation, which was made about 10 years ago, which looks at the way in which at the end of the 19th century, in American law, corporations gained the exact rights that a person would have under law. And it gave them a whole range of powers and freedoms under law that made them enormously important, and talks about the impact on that, on
the domino effect of that up through.
Right through. Yeah. Even though it's been limited in certain ways, the domino effect of that right through into contemporary capitalism. So Locke is really interesting. He can be seen as an early defender of individual rights and the freedoms of the individual, but he can also be seen as an early defender of capitalism, of a particular kind that emphasises the freedom of the economy rather than individual rights. So there's an awful lot of different strands to be found in Locke, and it's really hard to say which one is truer to his philosophy.
Yes, yes. I also think, just in relation to, he also wrote about education.
Yes.
A little bit, and he's very interested in identity and, you know, how we create this image of ourselves, how we understand ourselves, and he was very influential within that. So he kind of defined the self through consciousness, and he felt that at birth, that our minds were a blank slate. He called it the tabula rasis. And he said education, so he said 9 parts of 10 are part of our education, come from our education. So to him, education was hugely important.
Yes.
In terms of, he said, education maketh the man.
Yeah.
That is it. You know, and I guess I find that interesting because he kind of also says that, you know, we have this innate sense of moral and ethical understanding. So
yeah,
that kind of contrasts.
How do they fit together?
That.
Well, one way they fit together is that we aren't necessarily born with this actual moral code stamped on our brain, but he said we have the power of reason to discern it, to find it out.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a little bit of a reconciliation of what looks a bit maybe of a contradiction, that we don't have it, we're not born with ideas, we're not born with the moral code stamped on our brain, but we have this capacity, this reason to find it out, to be able to work out that murder is wrong and stealing is wrong and so forth, but through the operation of our minds. He was very interested in education, and also, although he doesn't really, like many thinkers at the time, he doesn't give a role for women in politics and the treatises of on government, he believed in the importance of women's education. He corresponded with women philosophers of his time and so forth. So he was toning down a lot of his ideas because his main aim in this work was to argue for the right of people to resist government when it became absolute. And he knew that he would lose some of his male or misogynistic followers if he also went into, well, actually women should be involved in this as well. And so
yes,
forth.
Yes. And that's an interesting part when we're studying politics, that there, you kind of have this like, top level, you know, the reality when we're talking about theories and application of law and application of political theory, but then you also have this kind of underlying politics of the day, you know, as you talk about, you know, that he had to tone down certain elements of, had to be political in his own way of marketing his own thoughts, because he knew that they wouldn't fly, his theories wouldn't fly if he didn't only appeal to a certain type of people. So there is kind of like the top level politics of what we're trying to say and what we're trying to actually change, but then how we go about trying to make that change. Sometimes there can be a really very interesting story kind of that has implicated how we've gone about doing that. Anyway, I'm very conscious of your time, and I'm so very grateful that you gave up your afternoon to take part in this podcast.
I enjoyed it.
Oh, well, no, thank you so much. It's been absolutely brilliant, and I'm delighted because you were on my list from the start to come on board, so I'm delighted to finally nab you. So usually I like to finish up the podcast by asking our political thinkers to give a little bit of advice to any budding academics out there. So it can be anything, you know, in terms of, like, there might be, I guess, some of the students who are listening to this, and maybe there's people who aren't students who are listening to this, who are thinking, maybe I'd like to get more involved in politics or sociology or some kind of stream of political thought. So have you got any advice for anybody who's kind of thinking about delving a little bit further into this field?
Yes, well, I wasn't expecting this.
Sorry.
So, I mean, lots of advice, I think, probably, but where does one start? I think one thing is, well, important to have an open mind, to read the people that you think you might disagree with, as well as those you think you would agree with. And to try not to, depend on secondhand views of thinkers. Try and read what they have to say themselves, and give them the benefit of the doubt the first time you read them. What might be interesting in this, rather than what might be wrong in this? Some people look to reading what, say, politicians say or what a political thinker says to try and find what's wrong in them and catch them out. But before you try to catch somebody out, try to be open-minded and see what might they be trying to get at, and what might they be able to contribute.
So maybe not to bring, when you're reading other people's work, not to bring in a defined idea of what your politics are, but try to listen to what they're saying and be open-minded to everything.
I think that's really, really important. Yeah.
Fantastic. Yeah. Professor Easel Tonin, thank you so much for taking part today. Very much appreciated.
Thank you.